Be the destruction of Atworth beginning at 1 o'clock?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
Wednesday. Well, that was Monday. Well, 7 o'clock, first one hit. Right on the minute. And so the provost marshal, Len Atworth, said 106 fell on Atworth that night. I don't think so. Because I didn't hear what about. I heard about maybe 16 or 18 or 20 go off. So I had a bottle of scotch up. I had a bottle of scotch up.
Now, did you go anywhere for protection when a raid would begin like that? Or did you go any place special for protection?
I just stayed in my quarters. So a lot of them went to the air raid shelters. Had an air raid shelter just about two, three doors from where I was building.
But you didn't bother with it?
Oh, no, I didn't bother with it, no. If it's going to hit, I know that air raid shelter was going too, so what's the use?
What was the air raid shelters were, what, in the form of a bunker or something?
Yeah, they were downstairs in the basement of buildings and so forth. And they had a lot of cots and so forth down there, you know. Each one had his own sleeping cot and bed.
But you just sat back with your bottle of scotch and...
Yeah, but I didn't drink much of that stuff that night. I did. after about the tenth bomb came over, I did take a drink.
Well, the reason for him going on the radio in advance to tell that it would be destroyed, was that to give civilians an opportunity to get out of the town? Or?
Well, they just, for propaganda purposes, like Tokyo Rose, wanted to worry you to death.
Had much of the civilian population fled those areas, or were they mostly refugees?
A lot of them were killed in Antwerp. They stayed at home, most of them stayed at home except at night. Then they would go to the air raid shelters at night. Mm-hmm. One explosion there by a V1 hit a theater there in Antwerp, and they said about 927 were killed, but I don't believe that. A lot of them were killed. And then we hit, one hit right outside our headquarters there in Antwerp. That was the railroad station, passenger station. That hit one afternoon along about 1 o'clock, and it killed 33 that afternoon. That was just about maybe, I'd say, 200 yards from our headquarters, the railroad station, our headquarters, about 200 yards from there. A couple of our men got hit, not much damage, you know, but they were hit, let's see, two of them. Yeah.
What was the range of a V1?
Of a V1?
Where were they firing? Where were they coming
well,
from?
Well, I don't know. Never did find out. Montgomery cracked Antwerp. He went right on through. He didn't go into that, emplacement of those V1 and V2. No, he didn't go by that. He just passed it up and went on through. Went into Arnheim up there. That's where he got his tail spanked. I think 35,000 airborne troops dropped there at Anholm. I believe somebody said that the Dutch, that he failed to consult the Dutch about the tanks getting up there, coming up, and said he didn't pay any attention to it, and said he got to Arnheim or place up there, and so he got bogged down, and so that's the place where the Dutch told him that the tanks couldn't get through there. The roads wouldn't accommodate him. Now, whether that was true or not, I couldn't say.
in providing the logistical support that you did, where were the supplies coming from? What depot were they coming from that you were shipping them to the front?
Well, I have no. It was coming from England. I think practically all of them were coming from England.
But did they had to come through some French or Belgian port?
No, they were shipped direct from England into to Cherbourg.
Into Cherbourg.
On the ships, yeah.
I didn't know whether they came in at Cherbourg or Brest
no.
or where.
No, Cherbourg was the first port of entry we had, and Le Havre was the second. Mm-hmm. Now what I think the plan was to get two ports of entry there at the beginning of the war. Mm-hmm. They wanted the English, you know, Montgomery mm-hmm. to take Le Havre at the same time we were taking Cherbourg and also Collins, where he landed at the what was that place name? What's the name of that thing? Darn it, I knew it. Because I was Omaha. Collins' entry there was, and Montgomery in English with a sword. If I'm correct.
Did you say that the Vichy French caused you much trouble?
The what?
The Vichy French.
Vichy French? Vichy French?
They were the group that didn't cooperate very well.
Well, no, I don't remember any trouble because we were the railroad that didn't call the railroad. We were operating most of the yard there, you know, in Cherbourg. Mm-hmm. So then we turned it over to, if you operate the railroads in three phases, strictly GI, then GI and civilian. But all military operations would go first when we turned it over to the French too. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then it was a full French operation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Where were you on VE Day?
VE Day? I was in Herne, Germany. I think it's H-E-R-N-E, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Not far from Halpern.
Then there was how long a transition period was there after VE Day before you were able to turn the railroad, say, over to the German?
It wasn't long. No, just a few days. Of course, U.S. military came first. Mm-hmm. All military operations came first over the road. But then they could do whatever they want to with the railroad.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine y'all were kept quite busy moving American troops out of Germany and France there for months, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, after the war, you know, it's getting kind of short on petrol, they call it gasoline and so forth. Is this trip necessary? So, I remember the first convoy came through there, of trucks, you know, with boys from the front, going home. It says, going home, we had a big sign out there on the car, freight car, going home. Is this trip necessary?
Well, Well, of course, the trains operated on coal. How was the coal supply?
How what?
The trains operated on coal rather than petrol. How was the coal supply?
How were they supplied?
Was there a good supply of coal for the trains?
Good supply of what?
Coal.
Coal?
Coal. C-O-A-L.
Oh, yes. We operate diesels, too.
Oh, you operate diesels?
Oh, yeah. We operate diesels, too.
Uh-huh. I was assuming they were coal burning.
No, half an hour looked more than diesel.
Oh, okay.
Of course, we started with steam first.
Right.
And then it wasn't long after before we had the diesels operating.
I was just assuming, in ignorance, thinking that the diesels came after World War II was over, primarily.
Oh, no, we had a lot of diesels operating. Mm-hmm. Now, when the first diesels came over, I don't recall when that was first put in operation over there.
So once the war was over, and your work, you stayed until most of the American troops had been shipped back, I presume, did you not?
No, I did not. It just depends on the length of service that you've had, mm-hmm. and how long you've been, length of service. And so I wasn't long after the war was over until I was ordered back home.
Was that because you were National Guard rather than Regular Army?
No,
just didn't need.
You had to have so many months of experience mm-hmm. over there,
right?
And so that you could send home on that basis.
Did you stay with the National Guard after you came back home, or
no?
Got out of it completely at that point.
Well, I stayed in the reserve, not the National Guard, but the AUS reserve
uh-huh.
until 1956.
There was from not Greensboro, but High Point, a wonderful gentleman who was a contemporary of yours, who wound up as Adjutant General of North Carolina during the 50s by the name of Capus Wainick. Did you know Mr. Wainick?
What's his name?
Capus Wainick.
Capus Wainick? Yeah, I knew Capus Wainick, yeah.
Capus
Wainick was a newspaper man.
Right. But he was Adjutant General, head of the National Guard here in North Carolina during the Luther Hodges administration.
And Harding?
Hodges, sir.
Oh, Hodges. Right. Yeah, I remember Capers. Yeah, he is a Greensboro man. But frankly, I didn't remember him being Adjutant General.
Mm-hmm. He was.
Now, Metz was Adjutant General when I was in there. J. Van B. Metz.
Right. And Mr. Wainick had a varied career. He was a newspaper man. He was in World War I. He got into politics.
Yeah.
Was head of the Highway Commission.
Yeah.
Was Democratic chairman from North Carolina, and then was ambassador to Nicaragua and Colombia during the Truman administration.
Hey, I remember some of that, yeah.
So he really got around in
a variety
of things.
He had a varied experience, didn't he?
In your railroad career, you saw quite a transition from the early days when you were with railroading as a young man After World War One, up until the time of your retirement in recent years, any thoughts on that?
Any what?
Any thoughts?
Well, that was that wasn't too much, except the Southern Railway was the first major railroad to fully dieselize in the country. We fully dieselized in 1953. Hmm. We weren't operating the steam locomotive after 1953. And that really paid off. Hmm. Now we have, let's see, we bought the interstate, and we bought two or three other short lines. So we merged with the Norfolk and Western. Mm. Now it's the Norfolk Southern, named Norfolk Southern. We paid $1.49 of N&W stock for one share of Southern Railway stock. Mm-hmm. That was the basis of which we merged. Talking off and western, you know, the coal handling line.
Right. Your major, or one of your major repair and maintenance centers was there at Spencer's shop.
Yes, that was on the eastern lines. Because we had another shop out on the western lines, but the major shop was at Spencer.
Mm-hmm. Have you been there since the... It's become a historic site, and they've tried to restore it.
No, I haven't. I'm sorry. I want to go there, but because they can't get the workmen now. Hunt said he would take it over and finance it, but they haven't done it.
Well, they've done a lot. They've done a lot in the last few years, but it's such an expensive proposition.
Oh yeah, it is.
Very expensive.
Yeah. Walked a many mile around those shops over there.
They were hoping that the railroads would help finance that, and I don't think that worked out.
No. Now, we have a locomotive, the Smithsonian Southern Railway, passenger locomotive. That's a pretty thing. Number 1401. We gave it to the Smithsonian. And they had to build a railroad track from the Southern Railway Yard where we stopped it on into the Smithsonian.
To get it there?
Yeah, and they had to cut out a wall. They had to enlarge a hole in the wall to get him in there.
Wow. So it was actually driven to the Smithsonian rather than being hauled in on a...
Oh yeah. That's why that's a pretty locomotive. On the latest passenger locomotive.
Any other experiences that you can think of?
No, I do not.
When I asked you about any incidences, I was talking about such things as the V1 bombing of Antwerp and the story about the 16-year-old Russian boy that worked for you. That was the type of thing I meant.
I don't remember. Yes, one time in Hauthorne, Germany, we had a little old place, shop out, not a shop, a little office on the outside of one of the big buildings. I needed the glass to drink out of. So I got Nikolai up there, and I reached over my canteen cup and did something like this, you know, for some water, drinking thing. And so next thing I knew, Nikolai left. he came back in. I wasn't in the office at that time. So when I got back, I saw 16 glasses all lined up on the table that I had there. Just worn out table. 16 glasses according to size. that he went out and brought in one of the German homes, you know, and just reached by and picked them up and brought them home. He had 16 glasses according to height.
Well, now at the end of the war, did he go back to Russia? Or
well, we had to turn them back to Russia. We had. I'd like to bring him over here. I wanted to bring him over here, but couldn't do it. Couldn't get him on a boat to save your life. And so he was very disappointed. I told him I was going to take him to the United States when the war was over. And so they put out an order that they had to report to a certain place there in Munich, Germany. And so he had to go. And so he didn't want to go. Because one line, they had a record of some of those, you know, came over. I think they came over on their own accord. Some of the Germans.
Yes, sir.
And also the Russians. And so those that they didn't want, those that they wanted to send to a camp, concentration camp, the Russian, they'd go down one line, and others are going back to Russia would go down another line. That's what I was told.
Mentioned in Munich, was the railroad station there in Munich destroyed completely?
Oh, no.
Mm-mm. It didn't suffer extensively from the...
No, it just suffered one. We had one V-2 to They came in, the passenger station, of course, the lobby, you know, is up front.
Right.
And back here, they had a glass windows up above, glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. And so one V-1 hit V-2, hit that I-beam. That I-beam was just about that wide. Hit that I-beam and go going over the passenger, where the passenger trains would come in. And boy, if it had hit down a little bit further, it would have done a lot of damage. But it just damaged the part of the building from that I-beam up. And very little damage down.
That was after the Americans had occupied Munich?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now, I had thought that the bomb...
No, that was Antwerp.
Oh, you had mentioned Munich there.
Oh.
And I was thinking the railroad center there in Munich, which was a huge metro train complex, had been pretty much destroyed by the Americans in the bombing of Munich.
No, it was not. They cut the heart out of Munich. The bombing of Munich,
mm-hmm.
They cut the heart out of that, but on the outside there, I don't think there's any damage at all. Very little.
I was in Munich last April. It's a beautiful city now.
I bet it is.
You were saying that there in World War One, you were stationed at Fort Eustis. Was that a transportation center at that time?
Oh, no.
You know, it is, in recent years, has been the Army Transportation Center.
At Eustis?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. I was stationed there for about 18 months back in the 60s, and that was the home of the Transportation Corps at that time.
Oh, it was. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Camp Eustis, Virginia.
We always call it Camp Fort Eustis.
That's where I was when World War One ended. Left Fort Caswell and went up there. 136 million.
Well, I believe that's about all the questions I have.
I'm sorry, I can't give you anything.
Well, you have.
We would hire the German people to stay in the roundhouses. Mm-hmm. When we got into Germany, there were Germans waiting in the roundhouse there to go to work, believe it or not.
They just assumed that they were.
Why, sure. They assumed that they, of course, we needed them too. We didn't have enough men now, you know, to put all those German locomotives in condition. They were waiting right there in the shop and in the office ready to go to work. We got in there.
And the train yards were intact?
Well, no, not all of them. No, they bombed, airports bombed a lot of them.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But those that were still up and not knocked down, you know. We hired, an American force hired a lot of the Luxembourg men and girls as clerical work, for clerical work.
Yes, sir.
And took them with them, gave them uniform. Not American uniform, but the Luxembourg uniform that they wore. They traveled along with the army. Paid them, I believe the secretaries were paid $22 a month. We hired a lot of workers there in Antwerp for the kitchen, to work in the kitchen, dining room,
right.
Diamond cutters. Paid them $18-$19 a month.
How did you know you weren't getting Nazis?
Oh, well, of course you could go to the Burgmeister in Germany. You go to Burgmeister. He had a list. Burgmeister had a list of them. You'd go to him first, and he'd send them to you. Had one lady there, you know, in Germany, that she looked after the girls. I called her the Fuhrer. Because she said, you want three girls? Like, tell the Fuhrer to send you three girls, or three men, to do this and do that. Next morning, she'd have them right there. And then when we left, some of them followed us from Haltern into Herne, and from Herne into Perth. Perth and Munich, you know, you can cross the street from Perth right into Munich. They're right together.
But you didn't have to worry there prior to the end of the war that you were getting saboteurs or...
Oh, no. Didn't have to worry that. Huh? They were first, the military government, you know. Mm-hmm. They sent a lot in there, you know. So they were cleared by the military government. Now, I had a secretary there in Munich, and she had married a German officer, a major, in the intelligence corps, but he was in POW camp. But military government cleared her. She could speak English. I mean, she could speak five different languages and take shorthand in five different languages. Her name was, what the fuck did that was her name? Olga. Olga Kern. I'd call her Olga from the Volga. She was a good size, and I'll tell you that. I imagine she weighed right around about 190 pounds.
The stereotype of the big, solid German Frau, huh?
The what?
The stereotype of the big, solid German Fraulein.
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. Well, I tell her I'm going to someplace there in Germany for the Third Army. she'd get in the car with him and go, and so if they saw any Germans in this entrance, and that was that we were the enemy, she would say something, hell, they just spread just like that. We had a whole door to go through. The voice she used too, she sounded like a Nazi SSS or something.
Well, I believe that
into the interview.